You will now hear from Steve Higgins on his work in All Things Considered, Thoughts About Cities and History, War and Peace.
The one thing I think that I'm trying to do in my work is to examine social and political structures that debase the citizenry, the humanity of where we live. For years, when I read books, I've always noticed the vertical or diagonal empty spaces between the text, and usually they run down the page maybe 3 or 4 or 5 lines. And rivers of white is a typographical term that describes those blank spaces between lines of words on a text. I started marking them in Tolstoy's War and Peace, and every time I found one of those rivers, I would mark it with a red pen, and they had to be more than 3 lines long. I didn't want just these little short things. And so I did that throughout the entire book, and then when I was finished, I trying to figure out what I was going to do with those things, you know, now that I had that information. And so I decided that I would divide the book into 25 sections and make 25 individual prints. And each of those 25 individual prints is composed of 56 pages of the book. What became apparent to me was that I was, in the process of doing that, revealing a structure of the book that was pretty esoteric and also perhaps even subliminal. And then, so I figured, well, okay, that fits right in with the work that I do because I'm very interested in structures. The War and Peace single print is the sum total of all the rivers in the entire book. And what I did was I took every page and every river from every page and laid it on top of the previous one until I had completely done the entire book. And that was a lot of information for the computer to handle. And when I sandwiched them all together into a single image, the computer intervened, and what we have in that large print is the way the computer saw all of that information. I had taken on a project of examining architecture, individual buildings, trying to find out if there was a similarity among different types of buildings, a kind of archetype. And so I looked at everything from schools to library to hospitals to, you know, you name it. I just kept looking at these things, these categories of things. And the 4 etchings are 4 of probably 20 or more categories, and they're an amalgam of everything that, for example, in the school, I might have had 25 different drawings of schools, but the one that you see in the etching is an amalgam of all of those schools, what was kind of essentially consistent throughout all of those. And when I was finished with the drawings of all of that and started to make the etchings, I started to understand that I had a narrative here. So it starts out on the left with the school, then it goes to the mobile home park. The mobile home park then moves to the cemetery, and the cemetery is adjacent to a crematorium. The large wall drawings have been done over a period of years. Every once in a while I'll make one. The reason I do those drawings is primarily because they're fictions. And when you build sculpture, you know, you can't mess with the space of a material. You know, you put a board on a table, you can't make it also go under the table, you know, at the same time. So the drawings allow me that kind of expressionistic freedom to really create this spatial jumble. And if you follow various elements in the drawing, you'll find that they make no sense whatsoever. But together, they seem like this bundle of shapes and various indications of ironworks. And I was particularly interested in the ironworks because early in the 20th century, at the end of the Industrial Revolution, iron became a revolutionary building material. And it allowed people to build buildings that were so much taller and stronger than anything that exists before. So the use of this material allowed for an expression of architectural power or institutional power. There was this huge competition to see who could build the tallest building, et cetera, et cetera. The downside of that whole thing was that we build these buildings that essentially tower over the city and also the citizenry of the city. So they become kind of anonymous places where people work or live. And that's in direct contradiction, say, to communities where the height of buildings is lower, so that people get to know their neighbors, and there's more of a sense of community. So these tall skyscrapers ended up kind of reading as monuments to either a corporate or a governmental ideology. And I think that ultimately is another example of a failed utopia, that the drawings, as I understand them, are really dystopic and somewhat apocalyptic. Urban 2 came about as a result of my knowing a certain neighborhood in Detroit that was probably had about 5 or 6 houses in the neighborhood, and it was obvious that they were occupied by very poor people. They weren't derelict, but they were homes to these people, and they did have a sense of a neighborhood. The city government tried to get these people out of there, and so they bought a lot of them out, but there were a few people that had lived there all their lives and said, "We're not leaving." And so what happened was that the city went ahead because they had a plan to build a freeway right through their neighborhood. And so they did it. And if you go down that freeway today and look off to the side, you'll see a couple of really tiny houses that are, the lawns are kept and all of this, but they're living now under a freeway. I inserted a California ranch style house with a swimming pool down there in place of the poor people, because those California ranch style houses were an expression of wealth, and they usually rambled all over the property, and they were surrounded by acreage and recreational areas and whatnot. And so I wanted to reverse the power there. I wanted, you know, an indication that the wealth of a citizen in many ways has absolutely no bearing on the intentions of either a government or a, you know, some kind of corporate mandate or something like that. Urban 3 is a riff on what we know as company towns. And company towns were built primarily by a corporation or a business or something like that, so that they could create housing for their employees and all of this in the location where the business took place. A really obvious example of that is Hershey, Pennsylvania, where Mr. Hershey built the town of Hershey. There are many, many more. We have mining towns in Canada. You're probably well aware of those kinds of things. In Urban 3, there's also evidence of excavation, and we're not sure if the excavation is ancient or contemporary, but it has a kind of, it has a feeling that there was some interrupted excavation occurred, and then a reclamation of that, and the institution of another excavation going on. On the opposite side of the pit, around to the side, you'll notice that there's this curved surface with these little niches carved in them with little houses, look like Monopoly houses on the, in the side there. And if you look at them closely, you'll see that all of those houses that are in the side are of differing sizes. So the ones at the top are huge, and the ones down at the bottom down at the bottom end of that large wall are really small, and that is an indication of a kind of hierarchical relationship amongst the occupants of a corporate town. The higher up and the better view you get is obviously associated with someone that's running the place, and all the workers are down in the bottom in the pit. And there's also an indication, you know, kind of like a pipeline or something that's down at the bottom of that. So you're not really sure if what's going on in the pit, if that's somehow connected to that or not. But it's just to kind of create this question about the ethics or the morality of that as an urban space. Okay, urban four. The situation in there is based on many visits that I've paid to Paris. And I've wandered the streets a lot, and I've photographed, and I've documented various neighborhoods. And one of the neighborhoods that I really, really enjoy is a medieval neighborhood that is really close to the Rue de Rivoli, which is one of those more wide boulevard streets with all the tall buildings, the architecture that looks like it came out of a cookie cutter, and all of this. So what I wanted to do in Urban 4 was to set up a hierarchical division between what I consider to be the aristocratic side of the piece and also the other side, which I refer to as something that's maybe more middle to poor class, maybe manufacturing goes on there. Dividing those two areas is what I call a ceremonial axis, and I intentionally made it look really fascist. So at one end of it, there's this kind of ziggurat-type building, and then all the way down at the other end is something that looks like a triumphal arch, something like that, and it's barren. So the implication is that that's perhaps occupied by people at some point in time for major celebrations. Right at the bottom corner, outside, down into an excavated pit, on the aristocratic side, is an observatory. And it differs from the aristocratic side and the other populated side by the fact that all the boulevards on the aristocratic side point toward the seat of power, i.e. that ziggurat that is at the end of that ceremonial passageway. The side where the manufacturing or the poor to middle class lives has a rather rambling street design, so it's not paying any attention to the more the expression of power. And the observatory, opening of the observatory is turned away from that ziggurat and looking out away from all of the situations that are occurring with the city streets. And what I wanted to indicate there was that the observatory represents another kind of order, that you can look outside of government or of corporation or whatever, and you can find order of another magnitude. And so I wanted to set up those three kind of contrasting situations to indicate that there are choices. I wanted to, in Urban 5, I wanted to set up a work that spoke to hierarchical status. And what you'll notice if you look carefully about the platforms is that access from one to the other is not possible. So it sets up a kind of, what would you call it, a metaphor. For example, it sets up a metaphor for class. Now, I don't necessarily mean social class. That word class could be applied to hierarchical relationships amongst governments or religion or anything else. And, you know, those platforms are an indication that this, you know, that once you're in a certain level, it's very difficult to amalgamate in, you know, the other levels into your situation.